Looking for something exciting to read? How Does He, A Man About a Dog combines darkly comic short stories, powerful poems, and pulp fiction prose to create a heartbreaking and hilarious journey that readers will not soon forget. Read How Does He, A Man About a Dog collected writings for free with Kindle Unlimited. The ebook is available on Kindle and print copies are available on Amazon, The Book Depository, and more. Also, please check out the show notes. The following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
I hold back a lot. If I didn't, I would be my dark half.
The terrible Australian B. Jemine.
Probably the most iconic moment is the blood coming out of the elevator. Definitely not in the book.
It contains coarse language.
What is going on? What?
Mature themes.
We all know that Stephen King writes bullies to the extreme.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 20 of the King's Own podcast, the podcast with my co-host Super Marcy and I discuss the film and TV adaptations of the works of horror author Stephen King. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Good evening. Now, hello. I'm here. We're here. It is episode 20 of The King Zone. How did we get here? I don't know.
Indeed. We're up to episode 20 now, and I think we're pretty much just over the halfway point till at least all of our set episodes so far of the King Zone.
There's about 50,000 King adaptations in the works, so I don't think this podcast is going to stop anytime soon.
Definitely not. But this is episode 20, and I didn't realize that until just before the podcast, so we have a lot to celebrate. So, and also, on this episode, we, Marcy, have a very special guest joining us.
Yes, we do indeed.
She is someone who we consider part of the family because she has been on many of our episodes of all of our shows over the years. And I would say she is, I consider, a legend of the Super Network. And that, of course, is Amy Hackery. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Thank you for inviting me in. Now, meet your doom.
Blah, blah, blah.
I did not say blah, blah, blah.
Indeed. But if anyone's wondering why we're making very vampiric references so far on this episode, there's a good reason for that, because on this episode, we're going to be talking about Cujo. Oh, wait, sorry, that's for another episode. Instead, though, for this episode of The King Zone, we're going to be talking about the 1979 and 2004 TV miniseries adaptations of Salem's Lot.
Bum, bum, bum.
Indeed. So we'll definitely be making a lot of vampiric references throughout the show. But before we do, Amy, how have you been since you were last on the show?
Oh, I've been doing okay. Just kind of busy with my day job. And we just, as of, you know, this recording, a couple weeks out of finishing a run of a play, local theater here. We performed 100 Lunches. It was called a gourmet comedy, and I played the part of waiters at various restaurants, and I was everything from like a snooty French waiter to like a slob working at a hash house, and it was a good old time. It was fantastic, you know, getting into these characters and just being flat out goofy, and the people who came enjoyed it a lot, and that was great. You know, that feedback just gets you going even more. And it was the first time I performed in front of a live audience as far as theater goes in 2 years. We did a show last year that was no one was in the theater, it was just us, and we were masked and we streamed it online. So being in front of a crowd, first time in 2 years, it was a long time coming, and I had a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
It definitely is. And you can definitely, and I can imagine that it would definitely be a certain different type of thrill from that being back on stage in front of a live audience after that long.
Oh, absolutely. And in terms of it being a comedy, it just feels you'd be like, oh, they're laughing at this. I can maybe tweak this and get a little bit of improvising. And sometimes I had to do that because we had like restaurant signs on like the set. And a couple times, like, they just straight up fell. One of them, the signs fell on me during the last show. And it's like, you can't break character. You just got to keep going. And we did and just kept in tone with like the silly sense of humor that the show had.
Awesome. And I'm glad that the show went really well and that you still had a lot of fun. And of course, you're joining us today to talk about these two miniseries with us.
Yes, and I should say thanks a lot for having me as a guest.
Bah, bah, bah.
Marcy is seething in silence.
Yep.
Marcy seething in silence just as much anytime I make a joke on any podcast. Any type of pun.
But, I'm just going to be like,
Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, we have two pretty interesting mini series to talk about on this show. So I guess at least one of them anyway. But
because there's actually another adaptation of this in the works. I suppose, you know, whenever that comes out, if it's 2022 or something, we'll all be back to discuss that also.
Oh, definitely. I know it is scheduled for September next year, from what I remember.
I believe it's getting cast at the moment.
Yeah, they've got because it's going to be a movie version of Salem's Lot, and James Wan's producing it, and Gary Dolberman, who wrote both it chapters 1 and 2, and as well as all three Annabelle films, including directing the third one, will be directing and writing this one. And it's got a pretty interesting cast that they're getting together because they got Lewis Pullman, Bill Camp, William Sadler, Felu Adu? I don't know. He's from Game of Thrones. That's all I know. it's hard to pronounce his name. And also, I believe, trying to remember who else was cast in this movie, but there's a whole bunch of people they cast in. But yeah, it should be interesting seeing this version of the story on the big screen. And I know that they actually are setting it in the 70s.
Yes, I have heard that, yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen set photos and it kind of indicated like all what they're decorating is making it look more 70s than modern, which I think will make it look really cool. But but it'll be at least a year before we get to that movie. But in the meantime, though, we'll talk about these two miniseries. So we'll start off with our first one, which of course is the 1979 miniseries version of Salem's Lot.
Ben Mears has been away too long, and now at last he's come home.
The men fought at Valley Forge.
Daddy, come back safe.
Home to the childhood memories, to the old familiar faces, to a life unmolested by time.
And with your saints, let him rejoice in your presence forever. We ask it through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Home to Salem's Lot. A town too good to be true.
What was that?
Did you happen to notice the time when the boys left?
We shouldn't have gone through the woods.
It's a shortcut.
Then they should have been here half an hour ago.
Wait, Danny, wait!
Something is happening. Something terrible.
Henry! Where's Ralphie?
Ralph. Where's your brother?
Unless the kid disappears, then this. You're not leaving Salem's Lot, are you?
I'm not leaving. Don't you understand what's happening?
You?
Yes, I do. It's in the Marston house.
Good evening.
8. There's a dead man upstairs.
Bill! Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
Look at me. Ned Tebbett's body has disappeared from the morgue.
Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Bill!
Ben, Susan's in there. Run! No! Look at him!
Stephen King, the best-selling author of Carrie and The Shining, takes you on a startling journey to Salem's Lot.
Which was directed by Tobe Hooper, of course, is the director behind films such as The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Poltergeist, and as well as one of my personal favorite vampire films, Life Force. it was written by Paul Monash, based on the novel by Stephen King. And this miniseries stars David Soul, James Mason, Lance Cohen, Bonnie Bedelia, Lewis Ayres, Jeffrey Lewis, and so many more. And the plot summary for this miniseries, which I am reading off IMDb, is: a novelist and a young horror fan attempt to save a small New England town, which has been invaded by vampires. Now, Marcy, I know you enjoy a good vampire tale. Tell us your thoughts on the original 1979 miniseries of Salem's Lot.
Absolutely. This was one I actually watched for the first time when I was doing a column on Tobe Hooper. So I watched pretty much all of his filmography in the span of like a week or something. And I watched it for that. And then I thought, like, wow, this is really damn good. Like, you know, having seen some other King miniseries and then you see this, it's like, wow, this actually feels kind of frightening and not terribly goofy. And upon rewatching it for this podcast, like, this is just so damn good. Like, it has that slow burn approach, but it also keeps it very interesting as you get to know the characters. And you kind of, you know, the real horrors really start to creep in. And I just thought it was so effective. And I really like the style overall. And it feels like, it's weird saying it's a miniseries because it doesn't overly play off as one. It just feels like a 3-hour film. And it's just, I think, just a really good piece. Like, even with a miniseries TV budget, like, it looks phenomenal, and it still does. It holds up, like, really damn well. And again, yeah, just watching it, it's like, it's such an interesting film. And I know they made some differences with the book, and I'm not, because I haven't read it, but one that I understand is they changed the look of Barlow, and for changing it in this, and for Barlow barely appearing in the film, like, that's such a foreboding presence. And when you do see it, it's like utterly terrifying. And it really, really works for how they crafted this. And, you know, I kind of think, you know how there are people that think, like, oh, Tobe Hooper couldn't have possibly directed Poltergeist, but look at this, then look at that, and yeah, come on, people. Get with it.
Exactly. Exactly. But Amy, tell us your thoughts on Salem's Lot.
Salem's Lot, echoing pretty much a lot of what Marcy said, in that it definitely has held up since the last time I saw it. And it has been a long time since I've seen both this and the 2004 version. I saw them fairly close to one another, just separating by like a couple years. But still, it's been like the better part of almost like 20 years since I've seen either one. And I always had fond memories of this, you know, just got kind of creeping me the hell out. And just because I've seen a lot of stuff in the meantime, its impact kind of just kind of softened just a little bit, but still, just objectively, it's a really, really effective little horror movie. And like Marcy said, it does feel like a movie. And not to, you know, kind of get into the get a jump on like the discussion for the 2004 version, it doesn't have to be showy. It's very quiet aside from like the score, which is going like bum 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 bum, but I kind of like that. It lends itself to the atmosphere of kind of like this being, for the time, like modern classic horror movie. So this is like a Dracula where it's like instead of a castle, it's just a shitty rundown like house, like the house that everyone in town is like, oh, that thing is haunted. You stay away from that. But unlike, you know, the 2004 one where it's obviously like very showy and set up to be like every smear of grime and turned up piece of furniture is like carefully constructed to be like, oh, this is creepy. But in here, it's just like, yeah, it's just a friggin' like a tomb inside of a house. It's just a husk and it's just so creepy. And yeah, it feels much more like a small town you would have encountered back in the day. And yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
I do agree with both of you. It had been, until recently, it had been quite a while since I'd last seen the 79 Salem's Lot. I remember seeing it in my teens, because at the time, you know, I was starting to get into horror. And I was, like, checking everything out.
Mm.
And I think, of course, you know, my first, at least in terms of being referenced of this movie, of course, was on an episode of Treehouse of Horror from The Simpsons. so that basically is like when I first heard it, like what they were referencing in that episode. And I finally checked out Salem's Lot a few years later. But even then, before I watched it, I think I always knew of it because, again, it's like all those kind of like movies and miniseries, like growing up, you would hear like I would hear my siblings talk about. And Salem's Lot is such a distinct title that you just, as soon as you hear it, it's like you just don't forget that title. And watching it at the time, like in my teenagers, I remembered really enjoying it. But again, I hadn't, until recently, I probably hadn't watched it in probably about maybe over 20 years since I'd last seen it. So I was very curious to see how it would hold up in prep for the show. And rewatching it again, I got to say it right now. Now, we've done a lot of, you know, TV miniseries adaptations of King's work so far for this show. And we still have quite a lot to talk about in the future. And all of them have been kind of various degrees of success. Some have been good, some have been not so good. But I got to say, without a doubt, of all the ones that we have watched so far for this show, I still think this one is still the best Stephen King miniseries. I don't know what it is, because I guess, like you say, Marcy, it flows more like a movie than an actual miniseries. And of course, you know, the DVD and Blu-ray these days just combine the two sort of parts together. So it does feel more like a movie. And I mean, it's not to say it doesn't have its TV qualities as well. Like, it definitely does have that sheen of a 70s TV show or movie.
And you have a couple of those moments where it's like it fades to black and like the orchestra goes, like, okay, here's the commercial break. But
exactly. But at the same time, though, since Tobe Hooper, you know, this is him coming off the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and I think his prior film, Eaten Alive. This, you know, those two films were very much really dark and grimy and grungy films. So to see him tackle this miniseries, he definitely takes a much more classical look and approach to this miniseries. But at the same time, though, he brings such a cinematic style to this series. And also when it comes to the film's many scary moments, they're so effectively done, and I've forgotten how actually genuinely creepy and actually scary this miniseries can be at times.
Yeah, really.
Like, there are moments, like, I was actually taken aback, like, shit, this is actually giving me scaring the shit out of me right now. Like, especially, like, the scene when Barlow turns up at the jail cell, like, he opens up a door, and the guy's, like, saying who that is, and all of a sudden, one of the best jump scares, like, Barlow's face just, like, zooms up at the screen and makes you jump. And, of course, one of my favorite, like, creepy moments is, like, towards the end of the miniseries where they're, where Mark and Ben are down in the basement, they're about to kill Barlow, and of course, Mark has his back towards like this little sort of tall space, and the light's going swinging back and forth, and every time the light swings into the door, you can see the other vampires like slowly crawl towards Mark. That shit is terrifying.
That was one of my favorite shots of the whole movie, and that scene, like, stuck in my mind since I, like, very first saw it. Just, like, crawling after him slowly. It's just, like, oh, like, fucking bugs crawling out of the sand or dirt and stuff. It's like, oh, it's so creepy. It's so cool.
And also, all of these scenes are so effectively done. Like, and they're staged incredibly well. But also, I think what struck me most about this miniseries, again, you know, Toby Hooper taking a much more classical approach to the material, but at the same time, though, like, he takes a much more subtle approach as well. And also, like, yeah, there's a score throughout this miniseries, but how it's sort of done is much more subtle, and it only really hits when something kind of major happens. Like, most of the time, there's barely a score at all, even in some of the scary moments as well. And also, like, the cast are all on point. Like, I was kind of thinking, I wonder how David Soul is going to be as Ben Mears. So, like, we all know David Soul from Starsky and Hutch. So I was kind of wondering how he'd be. And I thought he was really good in the role. And James Mason, who plays Barlow's familiar, Richard Straker, you can tell he is having an absolute ball playing this character. And apparently, like, from what I've read, when he got sent the script, he jumped at the chance to play this character because he wanted to do this miniseries. And you can just tell he's having a blast. And also, like, all the supporting cast are all really good. And it's like a who's who. Like I said, Jeffrey Lewis is in there. And also the late Fred Willard's also in this miniseries as well. Very young Fred Willard, I buy that. And, of course, Bonnie Bedelia, who I'll always have fondness for because she's the only celebrity with my name as part of hers. And it's just a really strong and just really well thought out series. And and I like the fact that it does, like, yeah, of course, sort of reading up the differences between, like, the book and the miniseries, like, there's definitely some changes here and there. Like, some characters were combined or other characters were kind of, like, sort of had their roles diminished in the miniseries. But that being said, though, I think the miniseries does a good job at sort of delving into the sort of the life of this small town and this community and how this kind of vampiric plague, which now, in, like, given that we've been in this COVID pandemic for about nearly 2 years now, has some kind of rings true in some ways, where there's people getting in becoming vampires and all that. So so basically how this small town deals with this sort of vampiric plague and, like, how it slowly kind of changes the entire town. And I also like the fact that in quintessentially King style, like, even though, yeah, there's a vampire in the attack in this town, like, but the house at the center of it, it's what was that? I'm sort of looking it up now. The
Marston House.
The Marston House, right, yeah.
The Marston House. I knew it was an M and I was trying to think of what it was.
Yeah, but it also has its own history as well, which I think the miniseries did a good job delving into. Like, this house that kind of feels like, even Ben Mears even asks, like, can a house actually be truly evil? Like, can a house, like attract evil? Because there's, like, a little horrible things that happen in this house, including one time when Ben Mears, as a child, he went into the house and he believed he saw a ghost of a guy named Hubie Marston, who hung himself there, like, years prior. Like, it's also, like, the house is also a character in the story who also has its own kind of history that's completely separate to before Kurt Barlow showed up. But, yeah, I just think it's just an overall, like, I mean, this was the very first King miniseries as well.
And it may still be the best one.
Yeah, definitely.
If not one of the best ones.
Yeah, you're not going to get any argument out of me. This is, like, easily the best that I've seen.
And, you know, there wouldn't be another TV miniseries of King's work until 11 years later with it. So, I'm very much impressed on this rewatch of this miniseries. I think it's just top shit.
Yeah, it almost feels weird calling it a miniseries because it does feel, like I said, it does feel like a film. And, you know, everything we've said, it all kind of lines up. We definitely feel the same about it. But it's just something special with this. It just works. The way that it has this incredible like, build to what's coming, but it's this slow build. And now slow builds can sometimes not work. But when they actually work, you're so invested, though, because you've got, you know, as you learn more about these characters and you're getting, you know, the history of this house, the town, and then you know that there's something else going on because, you know, there's new, you know, new person in town. What's the name? Richard Straker. And it's played so gloriously by James Mason. Oh, my God.
Poor little boy. You can do nothing against the master. Stop, holy man! We've cut the boy's throat. Back, back, holy man, back, shaman! Back, priest! What would you give for this miserable boy?
What do you ask?
What would you give to reprieve him this night, to save him for another night?
What do you want?
The master wants you. Throw away your cross, face the master, your faith against his faith. Could you do that? Is your faith enough? Then do it.
And trust him to let the boy go? Run!
They're dead, Father.
Run!
I'm going to kill you.
Now you're part of the bargain.
I'm a priest.
A priest? Throw away the cross. Face the master. Faith against faith.
I love it. Absolutely love that performance. But, you know, your investment is there. Your curiosity is there and it just keeps going. And then when we actually get to the moment where, I can't remember the kid's name, is a vampire at the window, like, that's fucking so terrifying. It's such an iconic visual. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of like the Lost Boys are going to use that shit, mate.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's like, like Beat said, when you hear, like, James Mason jumped at the role, like, he isn't the kind of type, like, in this one to be like, oh, that's a silly vampire movie, I'm gonna make a scene and be like, whoo, he's gonna get you, blah. Like, he plays every note so perfectly, and, like, he uses basically, like, the same inflection towards, like, the middle or, like, the second half, where he and Barlow kind of invade Mark Petrie's house, and he's just sitting there and saying, like, face the master, and, like, he says it with, like, the same kindness and inflection as, like, oh, welcome to the town, and like, all that stuff. So he just plays it so well, and he's so goddamn creepy. He's so good. Mm-hmm. And going back to what Bead said about Toby Hooper kind of taking on some in, like, classical influences in terms of, like, you know, older, like, haunted house horror movies and stuff, like, for this. It does seem like he combined that with the sort of, like, domestic horror that he had in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, instead of, like, a rural, you know, Texas town or whatever, which is, like, out of the way and things are just run down and the economy is for shit and all the businesses have run out of town. This is like a pretty quaint small town, a lot of upper class, you know, working class folks here, and it's like a very picturesque town, but not, like, so cartoonishly so. Like, it looks like a nice town. And but he brings those influences of, like, of the horror that's, like, lurking just beneath the surface. And that's going back to what Marcy, I think all of us were having a conversation a while ago about that being a very recurring theme in King's work, where it's just like the horror is a reflection of what's already there in the town in terms of, like, evil or inactivity.
Yeah, and that's why I actually think, like, Toby Hooper and King, having this adaptation, like, it suits them, because when you look at, like, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Eaten Alive, like, the story is being told, it's like that under the surface kind of stuff that's there, but people just don't want to acknowledge that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's very much what King does. He unravels, like, you know, the town people. And I feel like, you know, Hooper has done a lot of that stuff just throughout his, you know, his career. And that's why I, you know, it to me, it just feels like such a good fit for you know, to kind of, they understand it is what I'm trying to get at. And that's why I think it works. Like, Toby Hooper as a director understands that kind of stuff. So as he's directing it with the script, it's like really, I feel like, just elevating the material.
I want to try out something here. What did you think was the most Texas Chainsaw reminiscent shot in the movie?
You know what it was for me? The shot when Bonnie Bedelia goes inside the Marston house for the first time. I don't know what it was about that shot, because it's like one long continuous shot that kind of starts off being on her and then kind of zooms out to show the entirety of the house and how decrepit it is inside. That kind of gave me Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibes. I don't know why, but it just did.
Yeah, there are definitely moments like that. You can definitely feel it.
Like, because the one I was thinking of, the one that, like, screamed out, like, okay, this is the guy who made Texas Chainsaw, was in that house, like, towards the end, when the doctor's walking up the stairs, and Straker comes out and just lifts him up, and there's just, like, a wall of antlers, and that just seemed like, okay, this is, like, very reminiscent of Leatherface's lair and his collection, like, the bone bench and everything like that, and he just shoves him on there. That was really nice. And it was a shot that was set up, because you see examples of, like, stuffed cats and stuff, like, all around the house. So it's like, yeah, this is a hunter displaying, you know, his catches, his prey that he's caught. And, yeah, so he would have just a wall of antlers at the top of the stairs.
And also what I really like about Toby Hooper's approach to how he did with the vampires is, and this is one of the most creepy aspects of the vampires in this film, is, like, even when the scene is dark, their eyes are bright. And they use but it's the type of contact lenses, like, if you shine a light on them, that, you know, like, they kind of give that sort of like, you know, when an animal has a light on them, their eyes kind of, like, shine and reflect.
Yeah.
And it kind of looks like that, but it just looks way more creepier and eerie.
Yes.
In this scene, particularly the scene where I keep forgetting the character's name, so I apologize. Burke, the school teacher, goes up to see
Ryerson.
Ryerson in his room, and he's just sitting in the dark, creepily just swinging back and forth on a chair, and then it's like he opens his eyes, and it's just, that scene is also incredibly chilling as well.
Definitely.
And I can't speak for the accuracy to the book. Like, I haven't read it, and I assume, like, both adaptations have their differences for one reason or another. So I don't know how Barlow was precisely depicted in the book, but I like that his version here, which is, I believe, Reggie Nalder played Barlow, where he's almost just, like, beyond, like, he is an animal, like, he is beyond, like, he can't even talk, because, like, I forgot David Soul's name, Ben Mears and Mark Petrie are, like, down in that basement, like, staking him, he's just making, like, it's just like, this thing has never, this is a thing, like, it's never even spoken, it doesn't need to, which is why, like, where, like, Straker comes in, where he's just kind of, like, the mouthpiece for the vampire, is also, and kind of like its cheerleader or hype man in some respect, because when they're at the Petrie house, he's just like, oh, the master's coming for you, this is gonna be great.
And you know what's interesting, because I think I read this somewhere, that if you put, like, to me, how sort of Toby Hooper, taking, surprisingly, another Steven Spielberg approach, is we barely see Barlow throughout this whole movie. For the most part, we kind of just hear about him.
Mm.
And then he kind of sporadically only uses him here and there throughout the miniseries. But apparently, from what I've read, like, Barlow himself only has at least about less than 2 minutes of screen time throughout this whole miniseries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he knows he uses him well. Even though it's like, I know Reggie Nader, who played Barlow, was a bit pissed off about that because he had a lot more scenes that were cut from the miniseries. And I can definitely understand his criticism in that regard. But even though it's only 2 minutes of screen time, like, how it's used sporadically throughout the whole miniseries is so masterfully done because, again, like the shark and Jaws, you don't need to see, like, Barlow all the time. You only just need to see him when you need to, and when he does, it's only for a split second. And it adds more of an impact.
Yeah, the way that it's done, you feel like Barlow's in this film a lot more than he is.
Yeah.
It kind of tricks you into thinking that, and that's, like, just so good.
Yeah, and, like, when you think of Salem's Lot, like, you think of that, you know, that poster of Barlow with his, like, hands over the town just, like, looming over, and, like, you think of that, like, the blue skin kind of Nosferatu looking like demonic vampire, and, like you said, he's only in the movie for, like, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Although I do have to say, like, as effective as the movie is, I did get a laugh out of, like, towards the end of the movie when they're trying to stake Barlow in his coffin, and his head pops up, like, and then David Soul just, like, punches him.
Because you thought you would.
I just instinctively laughed. It's like, you're just punching a vampire in the face.
To be fair, we would all do the exact same thing if a vampire just went, bleh, and then smack.
Wink. Oh, fucking fist in the face. Punch in the face.
And also, let's not forget, like, it's very obvious that Barlow's design in this film, of course, is meant to look like Max Schreck's in Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ironic because the remake of Nosferatu, Nosferatu the Vampire, with Klaus Kinski as Max Schreck, or Count Dracula in this version, not Count Orlok, came out the same year as well.
From one of our favourites, Werner Herzog.
Yes, that's the movie I made. Because I'm one
of... They should have called that version Nosferatu 2. Number 2.
Yes. Nosferatu 2 to the streets. I guess, but there's a couple of things that I also want to kind of make credit about this miniseries. Of course, it kind of chats the hallmark is, I would say this miniseries, what I think is interesting, because this is the very first, like, Stephen King production, either in film or TV, that, of course, has one of his major trademarks in a lot of his work. It has the main character who's a writer. That's one. Because, you know, that's always, like, at least 95% of Stephen King's work has a writer as the main character. but that's true. I also think what is interesting is, like, what would make a good double feature with this miniseries is actually Silver Bullet, because, like, both those miniseries have a lot in common, because you got these kind of, you know, sort of European-centric kind of mythological creatures like a vampire and a werewolf, and, like, and Stephen King kind of was like, when he came up with both those stories, like, what would happen if those two things, like, happened in a small American town in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Like, how would the town sort of deal with that? And I know Dracula itself was a major influence on the King writing Salem's Lot, and hence the approach of, like, what would happen if Dracula just came to America? And I think that's what kind of gives it that sort of really interesting flavor that makes it different from other vampire films or TV shows that were at the time.
He borrows a lot of, you know, certain aspects of Dracula, but he made it his own.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's Salem's Lot, and you know, I was going to get to this as well. So, I mean, obviously we all had it in our heads to talk about, but yeah, Salem's Lot is basically Stephen King's Dracula, because it is like the way King sees the world, but with a Dracula-esque type character. And, you know, with as I was rewatching this, like, much like you, Bean, I was actually thinking about the Silver Bullet, because they are kind of, at least the this miniseries and film version are kind of similar in how it approaches it, but whereas we kind of know that there's like a main like vampire character who's very unseen, Silver Bullet kind of makes us wonder like who is the town werewolf, but then we find out. And obviously that kind of, you know, bad guy, quote unquote, is in the film more, but it's kind of, it is similar in the way that it does kind of dissect this small town stuff. And I do think it would actually make for a really interesting double feature.
Oh, definitely.
If there was any like major criticisms I can lobby at this, which there isn't anything like super huge that stands out, like at worst, there's a little bit of like wheel spinning in terms of like padding out the runtime. And the scene that comes to mind is when Ryerson and the other guy are like driving back to Salem's lot with the crate that we find out contains Barlow, and over he's like, oh no, it's coming at us. It's cold. We need to open it. It's cold. It's coming at us. Like, for 5 fucking minutes. Come on.
I guess if any criticisms I have of this with this miniseries is I do feel like there are certain subplots or characters that you think are going to become a major thing, but they kind of go by the wayside as the story progresses. Like there's a subplot where Fred Willard has an affair with his secretary, and of course the secretary's husband finds out and basically like charges it on him while they're about to have sex, and basically like scares the shit out of him and threatens to kill Fred Willard. And you think, oh, this is going to be like, you know, these characters are going to become vampires and all that, but no, they basically decide like to move town and just leave, and it's like, oh well, that whole subplot was a slightly pointless. It didn't really add anything to the miniseries.
How scary was that scene? And it didn't have anything to do with vampires. Shotgun on Fred Willard. He's like, come on, pick it up. It's self-control. You have that now, huh? It's like, oh god damn.
Yeah, it's a very intense scene, but the fact that it kind of like you feel sorry for this woman because now she's kind of trapped in this abusive relationship with this guy, but yet it kind of they just leave town before any of the vampire stuff happens, and that's pretty much it. I don't know. Maybe if they're I don't know if they were in like the book or not, or maybe there's more of them in the book. I don't know, but yeah, it's kind of just felt like, oh, we spend a lot of time with these characters, and then you know they're just gone.
And this is something that the other version we'll be talking about shortly differs from this one greatly, and we'll get to that. In terms of that plot device or that plot.
Exactly. And I also got to say, because I was watching this miniseries, and the constable in this miniseries, Constable Gillespie, played by Kenneth MacMillan, I was like looking at him, I'm like, where have I seen this guy before? And then I was like looking him up like after the movie, and I realized he's been in another Stephen King work that we have done for this show. He was in the Ledge segment as the gangster in Cat's Eye.
Oh.
And of course, he's probably best known for a lot of people as playing Baron Harkonnen in the original Dune film from David Lynch.
I knew I recognized the doctor from somewhere, and I looked it up. He was Father Dyer in Exorcist 3.
Oh, I did not know that, and that's awesome.
There you go, carry on.
Exactly. And also, I gotta say another criticism, like when Barlow attacks like Mark's parents, all he does is give just headbutt the two of them together, and somehow they died from that.
You just gotta trust it's vampire strength or something.
Yeah, that's true. It's vampire strength, but I do think that scene is really creepy because you see this black cloak come through the window, and it's just a cloak on the floor, and then it just starts to rise up, and I thought, oh, that's just fucking creepy, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of creepy moments.
I would have given anything for when he like smashes their heads together for like a coconut sound.
Or just like a bonk sound.
Boink.
But yeah, I guess that could be a wrap on this conversation of the 79 miniseries. But Marcy, tell us your final thoughts and rating for the miniseries.
Yeah, look, I think it's fantastic. Absolutely one of the best Stephen King miniseries. If you haven't seen Salem's Lot, absolutely watch this version of Salem's Lot. It's just so good. It's still so iconic, and it's definitely one that will continue to be remembered very fondly. And I give it a rating of 4.5. Gary Barlow. Kurt Barlow. who's Gary Barlow? Wasn't he?
Gary Barlow. Yeah, Gary Barlow is one of the members of Take That, Marcy.
I don't know where I got that from. I'm giving it 4.5 Kurt Barlows out of 5. Not Gary, because he's got nothing to do with this movie.
I'm going to be upset if James Wan and Gary Barlow don't actually cast Gary Barlow as Kurt Barlow in the new Salem's Lot movie.
Yeah. Gary Barlow is Kurt Barlow's, like, brother who never became, like, a Lord of Darkness. He just, like, has, like, a shitty car dealership and...
and has a pop career. Yeah. Amy, tell us your final thoughts and rating for Salem's Lot.
Salem's Lot, 79. I still dig it after all these years. It's simple. It's effective. It's fantastically shot. And, like, the cinematography alone just brings out so much creepiness. Lots of character actors you can see and enjoy who do great work, even though they're in just for, like, little bits of scenes here and there. So, yeah, holds up awesome. I would give it a good 4 out of 5.
Awesome. I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5. And I just think it's, for me so far for this series, it's definitely without a doubt my favorite of the Stephen King adaptations in terms of TV miniseries so far. I thought the 94 Stand was pretty much, I thought, by the end of the series, if we ever do, would be the number one for me. But after rewatching Salem's Lot again, it has now claimed that number one spot. It's just so brilliantly executed in a lot of ways. It definitely, like I said, does feel a little bit of a 70s TV show or TV movie at times, but I think Toby Hooper brings so much to the miniseries that makes it just stand out that that it becomes more than a TV miniseries. Like, it's creepy, it's captivating, and even though it runs for 3 hours, it just draws you in from beginning to end.
So you're saying Langoliers isn't better than this?
Well, it doesn't have Bronson Pinchot in it, but which is a big knock against the Salem's Lot miniseries. Although Bronson Pinchot as Kurt Barlow, I want to see now.
I want to see Bronson Pinchot as Gary Barlow.
Yes. Bronson Pinchot as Gary Barlow as Kurt Barlow. There we
yes.
go.
Yes. Scary little vampire!
I don't know. But we'll move right along to our next TV miniseries for this episode, which of course is the 2004 version of Salem's Lot.
I used to think nothing happened here. The truth is, everything happens here.
A dark secret.
When do we meet your partner?
In his own good time.
Awakened by a mysterious stranger.
I saw a plastic bag in the back seat.
Was it little boy size?
It was head size.
This June.
I know your name!
What about the house?
It scares me even to this day.
An old friend is coming home.
Susan!
Life is such a precious gift.
I don't know how to stop it.
Based on Stephen King's best-selling novel.
Let me in, Danny.
What's happening to this town?
Rob Lowe, Andre Brower, Rutger Hauer, and Donald Sutherland. Salem's Lot. Don't miss 2 nights of suspense beginning Sunday, June 20th at 8.
I happen to like it here.
Only on TNT.
Which was directed by Mikhail Solomon. And for those out there who don't know who Mikhail Solomon is, but he's, besides being a director, he's also an Oscar-nominated cinematographer, having been nominated for his work on James Cameron's The Abyss, and as well as doing special effects work on Backdraft. This miniseries was written by Peter Filardi, who also wrote the original Flatliners as well. And also The Craft. He wrote that as well. And, of course, this is based off a novel by Stephen King. And this miniseries stars Rob Lowe, Andre Brower, Donald Sutherland, Samantha Mathis, Robert Maiman, Dan Bird, Rutger Hauer, and James Cromwell. And the plot summary for this version of the miniseries is writer Ben Mears returns to his childhood home of Jerusalem's Lot and discovers it is being terrorized by vampires. Now, Marcy, I know, like me, this was your first time watching the 2004 miniseries of Salem's Lot. What did you think of this one compared to the original?
Yeah, what the fuck was this? Like, seriously. that's really, like, the way this starts off, it's like a homeless-looking Rob Lowe stalking priest James Cromwell, and then they go out the window, and I'm like, what the fuck? What? And then Rob Lowe's like...
It gets attention.
I'm like, what? And then suddenly we cut to, like, you know, Rob Lowe going back to Salem's Lot and da-da-da. I'm like, what the fuck? That scene doesn't even become relevant until there's maybe, like, 30 or 20 minutes left, I think. And I'm like, what the fuck? But, yeah, like, this has a lot of changes from that one, and I don't know, obviously, how it compares to the book. Because I haven't read it, but I don't know what they were doing with some of it. Like, they kind of fleshed out that actual, you know, the doctor and the woman storyline. You know, he actually gets threatened by the husband to, like, come up with money. So he's like, you know, there's this whole plot about this stuff and, you know, how certain things are bonding him and Ben together. That's in there. And there's, you know, other bits and pieces that are there, but I don't think it actually really works all that well. I think there was potential for something to be here and for something to be interesting, but I don't think it actually pulls that off. And it's hard to say, like, what it is entirely. Like, this actually does feel like a mini series. The budget for this is very obvious. And it really, whereas the original feels almost timeless, this feels like it's from that era of the 2000s. And I'm just not sure. I don't think it was necessary. It doesn't overly give us anything new. Yeah, it expands some plot threads, but did we really need that? No. This feels like fucking 6 hours, not three.
And Amy, what are your thoughts on the 2004 miniseries?
Well, let me just start by saying a couple of nice things. Here are some of the few things I'm like, okay, this was done pretty well. I liked how this had a stronger connection in terms of, like, Ben Mears and his reasoning for coming to the town. Because you get this whole, like, other backstory of him having, you know, gone into the Marston house on a dare and saw Hughie Marston who hung himself, and then his wife was shot, and you find out, like, there's also a boy, and so he's, like, racked with guilt, like, was my inactivity a form of evil? Could I have saved him? And so that's, like, haunting him the entire time, which you don't really get that in the Tobe Hooper one. Like, you just kind of, like, get sort of vague, like, oh, yeah, some scary stuff happened here, and I'm interested in it. It's like, oh, okay. And so there was that, and I appreciated that. And I also appreciated how extensive or how committed it was to some of the more aspects of, like, vampire lore that people or movies and TV shows don't really bring up a lot, because there's a lot in here about a vampire has to be invited.
Yeah, I noticed that too, and I thought, okay, you know, these little bits and pieces, you know, make it a little bit different. And the fact that we get a lot with kind of that backstory and what's haunting Ben comes through a lot. So there are these little bits that, I mean, it could have made it a much more interesting piece.
Yeah. And the whole inviting thing, like, even extends to the point where it's like the Donald Sutherland plays Straker here, and he makes a deal with Brackett about, like, getting the property in exchange for, like, a real estate deal is going to make him super rich. And he's like, yeah, he wanted to make this. He had to be invited to the town. So even in that respect, only could Barlow and, you know, company just kind of move in and start taking over.
Mm.
And like, in the scene where Burke and Ryerson confront each other, in the first one, he just kind of, like, pops in, like, after, like, he's been, like, declared dead, and Ryerson just kind of comes back in, and he's like, look at me, look at me. And in this one, there's still that scene, but Burke invites him. He thinks, like, oh, he's wasted, and he just needs to, you know, spend a night in a warm bed or something. Mm. And that's Andre Brower's character, and Andre Brower, they say mention his character is gay, and you kind of get a little bit of, like, oh, he's may subconsciously have had ulterior motives for inviting him, but he's still, like, it's for good. And so in the house, in his house, in his bedroom, that's when Ryerson turns, like, and he becomes the vampire, and which makes the line "I revoke your invitation" mean that much more, because that's when Burke discovers, like, okay, this is a vampire situation that we're dealing with here, and I just let him waltz right into my home. And the first, you still get that line, but it's like, you invited him, but before he became a vampire. So does that still count, or is it kind of a confusing little nitpick? But I did like those. Other than that, God, this was dog shit. Oh, this was terrible. This was so flat and so laughable every time it attempted to be edgy with its violence, and someone, like, gets their head spun around and their body just twirls, and I laughed my fucking ass off. And that subtlety that made the original movie just work so well, like, there's none of it here. And, like, there's no better example than the Danny Glick scene where his little brother comes, like, in the first one. It's completely silent aside from the music, and he's here, like, scratching at the window, and he's floating. And here, they got to show off their whatever special effects, their $5 could get them. And so you see, like, Ralphie outside of, like, the hospital bed just like, come on, come on, Danny, just, like jumping here and there and everywhere. And, like, oh, God, this does not look good, and I am not scared. And I get that. This Stephen King in the same Saw 4 is a different Stephen King than the 79 one, because that one was when some filmmakers decide, like, okay, we're going to do Stephen King, but make it a little bit more subtle, kind of sand off all the some kind of the crazier aspects. And here it's heightened King. This is like Needful Things King, where everyone is amped up and everyone's, like, screaming at each other. And they're just like, if someone's terrible, they're the biggest piece of shit you have ever seen in your life. But they are just totally not equipped to really handle that in terms of, like, scripting and visual effects and how the performances go. Like, the direction is just so terrible, and almost none of it works. And it's just a chore to sit through, as Marcy said.
Indeed. I guess for me, this is my first time watching the miniseries. I've known about it for a very long time, so I was very much aware of it, but I hadn't seen it until we recorded this episode. And I kind of in agreement with the both here. This miniseries is not good at all. Pretty much every kind of subtlety that Toby Hooper brought to the 79 version is completely gone in this 2004 version. And watching this miniseries, it's basically one of my biggest main criticisms of this whole miniseries is the way it was filmed and directed. Like, This to me is like what it was. This definitely was felt like watching this miniseries. It definitely felt like it came from the early 2000s.
Yeah, it really fucking does. It really does.
In terms of how it's, there's a lot of sort of over stylized kind of direction, and also some, the way certain scenes are shot and done, and like it, and also even the flashback scenes are so overdone as well. Like, to me, it's kind of a mixture of that, again, that sort of high over-stylized kind of filmmaking from films from, you know, from the early 2000s, mixed in with how TV shows were kind of shot at that time, because there's lots of close-ups of people's faces and all that. And, like, the combination of those together kind of create this miniseries that, on a visual level, feels like a such so much of a mishmash of so many visual art and filmmaking ideas that it just doesn't work at all. And also, like,
I just sorry to interrupt, but I, on that topic, I just remembered that shot from when Ryerson and whoever else like drop the car, the crate off at the Marston house, and they're like going up the stairs. There's a like weird slow motion matrixy shot where it's like, oh, something's there. Like, oh, it's all frozen. We're going around. And you know they were so fucking proud of that. And that looks terrible.
What? And I guess at the same time, though, because I know, I don't think Mikhail Solomon, who directed this miniseries, had directed anything horror-related prior. So, and when you compare his work here to Toby Hooper's, like, you can tell that someone is an absolute master when it comes to how horror stage, because, you know, they've made horror films, and to compare to somebody who probably has never really worked on a horror-related project at all, and just thinks, like, oh, if I do it this way, this is this will scare the audience, right?
Yeah, it kind of has that feel, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And also, sorry, I was just going to say, there was just so much potential for this to actually be something really watchable and adding, you know, something different, because it's there in the script. Like, there are those massive differences. Like you said, that invitation thing really adds a lot to it. But also, you know, diving really deep into the Ben character and, you know, expanding upon some other ones. But then it's just everything else just doesn't really work. Now, Bate, you can continue.
Well, I was going to say, I guess if any credit I give for this miniseries is from what I've read about the book. At least the miniseries takes a lot of stuff and characters that weren't, like, either condensed or taken out of the 79 version and put in this one. Like, the Dr. Cody was, of course, a major character in the book, but they sort of combined him with Susan's father in the 79 miniseries. Like, that's what they did a lot, like, combined certain characters. And also the priest, played by James Cromwell, Father Callahan, he's a major character in the book, but he only has a very small role in the 79 series. And he actually becomes a huge character in the Stephen King universe, because outside of the Salem's Lot book, he becomes a major player in the Dark Tower series.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can definitely see. So, like, I appreciate those little things because you know, they expand on those characters. And, you know, there's also, and I also did like that, like, again, like, adding new characters, like, you get more of this sense of this town, especially with characters who were not in the 79 version but are in this one. So we get, like, other characters. And one of the things that blew my mind about this miniseries that I completely forgot is that this miniseries was shot in Australia, and a lot of the supporting characters are Australian actors.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I'm like sitting there, I was like, oh, I know all these people.
I'm watching this and I'm going, why does that dude look so familiar? And then I'm like, holy shit, I used to crush on him in Neighbours.
Exactly. Because you got like Andy Anderson, like Brendan Cowell, and Rebecca Gibney is in this miniseries, and also Julia Blake and Chris Hayward, who we've talked about on the on the Ozploit cast as well. Like, they've been showing up a lot they show up throughout this miniseries. And also one actress in particular, who Bree Desborough, who plays Sandy McDougall, who, you know, Dr. Cody's having an affair with, I was like looking at her, I was like, where have I seen her from? And I remembered her from the TV show Home and Away. And of course, Robert Maiman, who actually, I would say, out of all the Aussies in this film, he has the biggest role because he, you know, he plays Dr. Cody. He played the human version of of Blanka in the Street Fighter movie.
Really?
Yeah. And also, he's like a big named actor in Australia because he also starred in like the Underbelly series and a bunch of other movies and TV shows as well. So it was kind of cool seeing him as a major character in this miniseries. And I guess another thing that at the same time, like, sort of made things disappointing for me about this miniseries, because they got such a top-notch cast in this miniseries. You know, Rob Lowe, Samantha Mathis, Donald Sutherland, Andre Brower, and so many others. And for most parts, some of them, I think, do a pretty solid job regardless. But others, I just didn't feel like worked at all. Like, the Bedmans in this version, I will admit, like, even though, it's good that they kind of did more with his backstory for the reasonings why he's back in town, which I believe was done just for this miniseries, because the way that it was done in the 79 version was as it was in the book, but they sort of changed it up here to give him more of a reason to come back. Some of the actors do try to do what they can with the material, but it just doesn't work. I mean, I was legit shocked that Donald Sutherland, who I usually love as an actor, I just didn't feel like he brought anything to this miniseries. And the fact that his version of Strecker actually dies halfway through the miniseries was a bit of a shock. And he's not really that much of a major player at all.
Yeah, that's one of the changes that I do know was taken from, like, the book. Like, in the 79 one, the role of Straker was, like, beefed up more. But what I said earlier about, like, oh, James Mason didn't, like, look at Salem's Lot as a don't-give-a-shit role where he's just kind of gonna camp it up. Like, that's what Donald Sutherland did here. And he's just kind of like, whatever, I'm doing my paycheck. Ooh, I'm a spooky. Ooh, boo, boo, boo. I'm 1, 2, 3. I'm gonna get you, blah. And then he just dies halfway through. Like, he's killed by Barlow. For what reason? I don't know.
Yeah, that's not ever explained. And it's... You know, you can tell, like, he's, you know, this performance, he's not all that invested. He's just going to ham it up and whatever. But he still remains one of the more, more watchable performances.
Yeah.
Because it's not bland. And, like, you know, Rob Lowe was in the 94 The Stand, and he's really good in that. Then you compare it to this, and it's like, he is trying, but something's just not working. And, you know, it's so hard not to be distracted by that mid-2000s hairstyle that every dude had.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The best way I can describe Rob Lowe's performance here, it's like they make a comedy about, like, a hunky actor who wants to be taken really seriously, but he can't emote for shit. And so he's like, yes, I'm a very tortured soul. I'm coming back to this town. Everyone has secrets here. It's like, and he is just not selling it.
Ben.
Susan.
Did you kill him?
Why didn't it help you?
I don't need any help. I need you to be happy. May I come in?
No.
Ben. This isn't your house. And you're not a religious man. You don't have any faith to keep me out.
You're wrong. I do have faith. You push me to it. Listen, I wish you'd never gone into that house without me.
I was stupid.
Reckless.
I did something for you, Ben. I was so excited to tell you. I went to the hospital. After I saw Father Callahan, I found the records of the boy from the Marston house. Do you know how he died?
Very slow.
No. He was strangled. He died instantly from a crushed larynx. Ronnie Barnes was never alive that night. You couldn't have saved him. The crying you heard wasn't him.
I don't understand.
Even at 9 years old, you had a good imagination.
Yeah.
and speaking of Barlow, Rutger Hauer plays Barlow, and he's just some guy.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm. And I love Rutger Hauer. Like, he's a brilliant actor. And even if the movie or whatever is shit, he usually gives it his all, and he's always great on screen. But his version of Barlow is just such a nothing character. And I know this version of the character is more accurate to the book because although I want to see that version now. Stephen King, when he wrote the book sales on, he legit wanted, you know, like basically, as we would say, like it's Dracula in a small town. So that's the version of the Barlow he wrote was basically Dracula, like someone who could talk and looked human and, like, you know, looked more human as a vampire and, you know, could talk to his victims and stuff like that. Mm. And one of the big changes they did for the 79 was, of course, making him more of a Nosferatu animalistic type.
Which, yeah.
And while I give this miniseries credit of going for that more faithful version of the character, but when you combine this Barlow with the old one, like, I find the 79 version one more scary and more intimidating than this version.
It just felt like a non-event almost.
Yeah, and Rutger Hauer tries, although from what I've heard, there was a story behind, like, there's this big monologue that Rutger Hauer was going to do to sense to Rob Lowe before he's about to kill him, but apparently Rutger Hauer didn't bother to, showed up on set, didn't bother to know the monologue, and decided to ad-lib a whole monologue. But the thing was, the monologue was so terrible that they had to basically reshoot the thing and have him read off cue cards for the scene. God. So I think even like Donald Sutherland, I think Rutger Hauer didn't even give a shit while making this miniseries.
Rutger Hauer was more intimidating in those straight-to-DVD sequels to Dracula 2000.
I know. This is his first, like, one of three or four times he played a vampire in a film. And of course, let's not forget, Donald Sutherland and Rutger Hauer were also in the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer as well.
Yep.
Although as enemies in that version.
And going back to, you know, the Barlow, like, in this one being more human and he's articulate and he is just kind of, he still, you know, preys on everyone. But, you know, because there's the, he actually makes an appearance very early on. Then he, like, disappears for almost, like, quarters of the rest. But he has an appearance early on where Dud Rogers, the town garbage dumb guy who's, you know, has a physical deformity, and he comes to him and he's like, hey, I can make that go away for you. And he's like, okay. By the way, Dud Rogers, I totally thought that was Bud Bundy. It looked so much like him, and I was just like, is that David Foster? And it wasn't him. But
that's Brendan Cowell, one of Australia's national treasures.
Well, it looks not like Bud Bundy. But anyway, Rutger Hauer is there, and it's like, oh, we're already seeing Barlow, and he's, you know, basically kind of like making a Faustian bargain with him. It's like, hey, I'll give you what you want, and you can romance this girl. Just, hey, come on over here. And at that point, like, if Barlow's, you know, articulate and kind of making these deals and going out on his own, it's like, you don't really need the Straker part. And so it's in this really weird situation where it's like, yeah, Straker's like the human familiar and who has, like, even more powers than the James Mason one did, because you can tell, like, James Mason has some abilities because he lifted the doctor up by, like, one hand or, like, two hands and shoved him in the antlers, and he, like, made the, like, wind swirl. But here it's like, there's one scene where, like, they're breaking into the house and they trip a security alarm, and it's like, it's insinuated that Donald Sutherland, a Straker, just, like, teleports or does, like, the Flash and just comes on over, like, hey, what are you doing? Like, well, there might as well just be one guy at this point if you're
going to give
equal supernatural abilities. And
yeah,
fine, you don't need Straker then.
Mm. Yeah, it kind of does that. So I think, like, this actually had a lot of potential to be more than what it ended up being.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because you can see hints of something that would have really been interesting and, you know, a good, you know, when there is, like, a remake, it can be, like, a good companion piece. But it's just not really. You know, I'm curious to see how they go about doing, you know, yet another version and, you know, whether they do more book stuff or, you know, take from the 70s version or anything in this. I guess we'll find out in due course and we'll come back to discuss it once it's out. But, yeah, this one just doesn't really resonate. And, you know, I could have done without a whole subplot of that character who clearly wanted to fuck his daughter or perhaps was fucking his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
That was disgusting. And
you mean Sad Book Bill Pullman?
Yes.
Whatever the dude was. Because I didn't realize that the 79 miniseries combined those two characters. And then I'm like, oh, wait, there's two separate characters for this in this one. Yep. I forgot the cat bloody character's name.
Crockett.
Yes, Larry Crockett. It just, what was the point of all of that? It was disgusting.
Yeah,
I know the point of it was like, because what this does, it brings out more of that. Oh, there's shit going underneath like this, you know.
Yeah.
All American town, there's all these little stories, and there's a line Rob Lowe says earlier where it's like, we all have our secrets, and usually people look the other way. And that's why a lot of people are very apprehensive when Ben arrives in town, because he escaped, and so basically they're kind of like, oh, you have our secrets, you're a writer, you're going to tell them all about us. Which that's an interesting angle, too, to represent that hostility. Although, maybe not so much to justify, like, when it's like Ralphie or one of the kids goes missing, the town sheriff just immediately comes up and was like, hey, you're new in town, you probably fucking did it. It's like, well, geez, calm down.
And like, so there's a little sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, because, yeah, there's all that the 79 version lacked. But it says something where both this and the 79 version are almost the same length. They're just a hair over 3 hours each. And this one, you know, brings out more of those, like, character threads and goes into more detail. But that the 79 one just feels so much more enriching and authentic. And here, like a soap opera where everyone's changing the channel every 2 seconds. So, yeah, you're getting a little bit more, but you don't really care all that more.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you that some of those aspects about the town's hostility towards Ben, I thought was actually one of the interesting parts of this new version. And, yeah, but they don't really kind of expand upon it any more than that. And, yeah, it's just and also, one subplot I think was, for me, I felt was one of the strongest ones was, of course, the subplot with Father Callahan, who, of course, is going through a crisis of faith in this whole miniseries. And, of course, like him dealing with that and also having to even, like, he's being threatened with this very obvious vampire from hell, and yet he can't even muster up his faith to stop it. And then, of course, he gets basically, I'm not sure what, a kind of a familiar, a new familiar.
Yeah, he pretty much takes the place of Straker at that point.
And I know that
it's all the light switches flicker. He's like, okay, I'm evil now.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting because that character was such, like, again, when I mentioned that this character also appears in the Dark Tower series. And King must have such an affinity for this character because, like, yeah, this character kind of, like, goes down this path in both the book and this miniseries, but the character over other books starts to regain his faith again. So it's kind of interesting seeing that. Like, I thought, maybe they might do something similar to that in this version, given, like, you know, this is not going to be tied to any Dark Tower properties and all that. But no, they just make him familiar and evil now, and that's just
And then he dies. Goodbye.
Yeah, pretty much.
I will give credit. Like, I think James Cromwell is actually pretty good in the role. When you compare it to, say, Donald Sutherland or Rutger Hauer, like, at least he seemed present for it.
Yeah, he definitely gives one of the best performances in the miniseries.
And I also... Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, look, I don't like dissing child actors or anything, but when you compare the kids between films there, they just don't really work here. Mm. You could tell they were trying, but it just did not work. And maybe I feel bad for saying that, and I don't want to sound mean or anything. Like, they just didn't work, and it's probably not really a fault of their own. That's what I wanted to try and do
with. Yeah, I was going to kind of say something along those similar lines. Like, if anything, like, the direction's more at fault. Because, like, early on, you can tell, like, when the kids are, like, fighting over the hat, there was a lot of ADR in that scene. So it's like, that's not the kids' fault, where it's like, hey, can we go over here? It's like, whatever. But I was going to say some of the performances I did like, I thought Andre Brower was very good. Like, he brought that. So, like, when he's confronting Ryerson, he's like, I revoke my invitation, like, get out of my house. I'm like, he is just trembling and crying. It's like, yeah, he delivers that. And I really liked, speaking of the child actors, Dan Bird as Mark Petrie was actually really good. And he was felt much more of like a social, you know, outcast who, you know, retreated from like his shitty life at school into like monster models and figures and stuff like that. And I thought he did a pretty good job, and I forgot about him because he was in a bunch of stuff right around that time. But yeah, I thought Dan Bird was pretty good.
Yeah, he was also in the Hills Have Eyes remake as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought he was definitely one of the stronger aspects of this miniseries as well. But again, I'm not sure. It's just, yeah, like, outside of him, most of the other kid actors weren't as good, which is kind of a shame. But I did like that, at least in this version. Again, maybe it's because we've been living in a pandemic for for nearly 2 years now. They kind of go dive into more of the plague aspect of this town.
Yeah, yeah.
And
which I think was really interesting, but it just didn't quite work. Like, when you get that scene, you know, you see everyone have kind of turned into vampires, and that fucking perverted dad character finds the daughter and then they just unleash on him. Like, yeah, that's great. He deserves it. But it's something that you didn't really, I guess, think about or see. It's like, this whole town is really plagued now.
Mm.
Which, you know, credit where credit's due, that they, you know, tried to do these different things. Well, they didn't really work out. Eh.
Yeah, I did like the visual in that scene of them just like scurrying through the trash because they're in the junkyard, and it's just like them crawling through bags and just digging and scavenging. It's like, yeah, that's a very animalistic shot there. So I thought that was pretty good.
And I got to say, because there's scenes in this hospital, like when we see Dr. Cody interacting with patients and that, then he's also interacting with another doctor. And do you know who that other doctor was, the older one? That is fucking Nicholas Hammond, the original Spider-Man from the 70s.
Hey.
And I know this because, like, he lives in Australia now. He's been an Australian citizen for, like, decades now. So I was, like, looking at it, I was like, is that Nicholas Hammond from the 70s Spider-Man TV show? And also the sound and music? And it was.
There you go.
Aussie man does anything an Aussie can.
And for some reason, like, even though he appears a couple times throughout this miniseries, he was uncredited. But I suppose, like, yeah, he was probably, yeah, I don't want to be associated with this miniseries. I'm going to leave this off my CV. He doesn't
have much to do other than look at the doctor and be like, hey, you're fucking that girl, huh?
Yes, exactly. Although, if he's not in the next Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse version as the 70s Spider-Man, I'm going to be upset to say.
Oh, man.
He needs to come back, damn it. But yes. I guess that could be a wrap on this conversation of the 2004 one. Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for this miniseries?
Yeah, I give this one 2 out of 5 Roblo haircuts. Look, it's kind of a curiosity, but unfortunately, I think it does fail overall. It's still a bizarre, interesting look at, you know, an adaptation and, you know, a relic of 2004. But yeah, I just didn't. It did not work for me.
And what about you, Amy?
Yeah, just like what Marcy said before, there's a lot of potential in here and some tidbits here and there are like, okay, that's pretty good, that works. But otherwise, the most of it goes unrealized and the visuals really date it and the whole project just kind of falls flat and just about everything that it sets out to do. I had said on Twitter a while back, like, all the departments where the Tobe Hooper one was scary and unsettling and effective, this one just makes you giggle and laugh at it and just be like, oh, sweet little movie. You just want to pat it on the head rather than be frightened by it. So, yeah, Salem's Lot, 2004, I'm going to give that a 2 out of 5 as well.
I'm going to get 2 out of 5 as well, and the 2 is for the top... is for two Rutger Hauers reading off cue cards. but I'm pretty much in agreement. Like, it is definitely very much a very... I don't like using the word dated or... because, you know, like, every movie dates at some point. But this is definitely a film that... I mean, sorry, miniseries, that very much is a representation of what early 2000s filmmaking was like. Like, all the kind of, like... over-stylized, over-the-top ways that, you know, a lot of films and TV shows were done in that time is very much present in this miniseries. And I think, again, and by kind of going for that over-stylized feel, it really kind of lessens the horror of what this miniseries could have had and lessens its impact as well. And while I do give it credit to try to stick more closer to the book, but at the same time, given that it's, you know, 3 hours long and the same running time as the 79 version, it feels much more overstuffed in a lot of ways. And this seems like most of the actors were kind of like, some were definitely on point and others were just felt like they were just there for the paycheck. Although I will say, I'm going to give it credit because this was shot in Australia in Cheswick, in here in Victoria. So basically...
I do remember when that was happening, like hearing about it. And I will say this, Rebecca Gibney makes for a very just like meow, kind of vampire. So.
A very sexy vampire. I mean, what? although this won't be the last time we talk about Stephen King properties being filmed here in Victoria, because in a future episode, we'll talk about Nightmares and Dreamscapes. Which a lot of the same team behind this miniseries also worked on, and they shot that year in Victoria as well.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that in a future episode. But yeah, I think as a stand, like, I haven't read the original books, I can't see how it compares, but comparing it to the 79 version, yeah, it's no contest. Like, this version just doesn't work at all. I mean, it has its moments, but yeah, they're kind of few and far between.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess, yeah. As much as I was disappointed that, I am looking forward to the new version that comes out next year, given, like, the talent that's involved with that. And I hope that, you know, they pull it off, like, sort of condense this down to a movie-like style. But given that, you know, it's written and directed by Gary Doberman and produced by James Wan, and having seen Annabelle Comes Home, and that definitely kind of in the filmmaking style is more along the lines of James Wan's work, hopefully that... the new version will kind of have that sort of go for the more, you know, classical kind of scares as well. But I'm really curious to hear how they're going to tackle Barlow in that film version.
Well, what we'll do is we'll send them this podcast so they know, like, what they should and shouldn't do. We'll just make sure, like, those changes to the script are there before they film.
Exactly. But like I said, I'm kind of curious, like, will they go kind of the more the Rutger Hauer route, or will they go to the more sort of the Reggie Nader route in terms of their vampires? I'm kind of curious. It probably won't be a while till we find out, but or maybe combine the two in some way. I'm not sure. So
I guess we'll see.
That's a wrap on this episode, episode 20 of the King's Own podcast, our first big milestone for the series so far. Of course, thank you, Marcy, for always being a very awesome co-host as per usual.
You're welcome.
And also, thank you, Amy, for coming on the King Zone and talking about these two miniseries with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, and I'm glad none of my coffin interrupted the show. You promised me vampire puns, and I've only been one doing them.
That is true. Blah, blah, blah. You could say, Amy, I'm a fang for your vampire puns.
C minus, see me after class.
Before we wrap up this episode, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
Well, people can sink their fangs into our content.
I like it.
You can find us at our base of operations at supermarcy.com. You can find all the podcasts and reviews and everything we do on the website. You can follow us and keep up to date at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. And you can also join the Super Network group, and you can see when we share our podcasts, do polls, or just share memes and movie news and all sorts of goody stuff. And you can find us on the Twitters at twitter.com/sm_supernetwork. We are also on the Instagrams at the.super.network and on the TikToks at the Super Network, and of course the YouTubes under the Super Network. But you could probably just look up Super Marcy or Bead or the Super Network, and you should find our YouTube channel. Please subscribe, and we are at all your major podcast streaming platforms. So if you listen to us where you can leave a rating and a review, please do so. We'd love to hear what you think, or just, you know, give us general feedback. And of course, you can find me on my Twitter at supermarcy.com, and you can check me out on Letterboxd under my username super_Marcy.
And Amy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Well, you'll go batty for my content online. I'm at twitter.com/callmeamydoll, Amy with an A-M-I-E. I only post so much about movies anymore, but throughout the month of October, I've got a couple cool trends going on, daily Halloween-related stuff. I have Spookoween Month, where I'm doing every day a different video, either like a nostalgic like commercial or horror related video games. I'm also doing Bimboo Inspo, where I'm paying tribute to a different like iconic person or iconic woman from horror, like throughout all the decades. And I am hopping on the hashtag train that Bead started, 31 things that made me a horror fan, and I'm doing those every single day. So again, I am at Call Me Amy Doll.
And I'm very happy that both you and B are doing my little hashtag that I created. It makes me feel very gooey inside.
Ew. I want to hear about Bead's goo.
Ew. All right. I'll stop. I was trying to think of a vampire pun for all that, but I can't think of one.
This conversation is draining me.
Oh, damn it. But if people want to find me, of course, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeeJamine, where I'll be, of course, doing my 31 things that made me made me a horror fan on Twitter. I keep forgetting, is it 31 things that made me a horror fan or 31 things that made me love horror? I can't remember. But it's one of those. Go to my Twitter page and find out. Yeah, I know. I created it, but it's just such a long one.
I know. You've got both, you know, you've inspired, like, both Amy to do that and also Beatrix as well. You should remember it, fuck it.
I will. I'll remember it after this podcast. But
he's a trendsetter who forgets his own trends.
Exactly. But also you can find also my 31 days of horror thoughts and opinions on all the films I am watching from my list this year, so definitely check that out as well. And of course you can find all my writings over at the Super Network with all my reviews and columns, and you can find my personal writers page on Facebook at facebook.com/terribleozzy. So that'll be a wrap on this episode of the King's Own podcast. We hope all of our listeners enjoyed it. And we'll see you all next month. See you, everybody. Bye.
Stay spooky.
Stay spooky.
Anymore, I want them to turn black. I see the girl. look away. Like a newborn baby, it just happens every day. I look inside myself and see my heart is black. I see my red door, I must have it painted black. Maybe then I'll fade away and not have to face the facts. It's not easy facing up when your whole world is black. No more will my green sea go turn a deeper blue. I could not foresee this thing happening to you. If I look hard enough into the setting sun, my love will laugh with me before the morning comes.
Mr. Straker.
Yes?
Do you believe that evil can be inherent in a house?
About as much as I believe that trees have souls.
Or perhaps they do.
Oh, you're the writer. On vacation or vocation?
I am writing about the Marston House.
Ah, and you'd like to visit? Oh, why not? Mr. Barlow is on a buying trip, but the moment he arrives, you'll enjoy Mr. Barlow. And he'll enjoy you.
The Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in these show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy Shark, do 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 do. Surfy Shark, do 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 do. And now back to the show.